This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Heather Van Norman, track and field coach at Nicholls State University and former LSU All-American and mother of Tigers receiving star Odell Beckham Jr. Odell Beckham Jr. caught six passes for 204 yards and two touchdowns Saturday as LSU breezed by Furman 48-16 after leading only 20-16 at the half. We'll talk with Heather Van Norman about her son and her remarkable life. Also on the show, State Treasurer John Kennedy. He has some concerns to express about budget woes in Baton Rouge and beyond. The man who ran for the U.S. Senate in 2008 against Mary Landrieu. We'll talk with John Kennedy about budget matters near and far. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. By email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Later in the hour, we will hear from State Treasurer John Kennedy. But a special treat to start the show, Heather Van Norman, track and field coach at Nicholls State University, All-American sprinter at Louisiana State University, a six-time All-American, and the mother of Tiger receiving star Odell Beckham Jr., who had a big game Saturday, six catches, 204 yards, couple of touchdowns, in a 48-16 rout of Furman. Good morning, Heather Van Norman.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you.
Nice to be on the show.
Well,
thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. You came to LSU from Minnesota a few years back. What prompted you to make your move south many moons ago?
Well, I appreciate you saying a few years back, right? But it was actually just everything that LSU has encompassed. I was recruited to go to LSU, and I just kind of fell in love with the coaches. I believed in the philosophy and the mission that they had, and I just absolutely fell in love with campus once I got down here. So it kind of encompassed everything that I could ever imagine. It had a great support system from sports psychologists to nutritionists, dietitians, and great academic area that I wanted to go into. So that is why I chose LSU.
And as I noted, you were a six-time All-American. I guess you were recruited by Pat Henry.
Yes, absolutely. Kind of, I feel like sometimes the founding father, the godfather of track and field, phenomenal. Kind of label him as dad, so to speak. That's the name that he got going out when I left the program. But absolutely phenomenal coach. And just, he's a great mentor for the student athletes. And he is an awesome person, so I really enjoyed working with him.
Well, you were an All-American, I think, the first time in 1992, and then later that year, you give birth to a young man, Odell Beckham Jr. He came shortly after you were running track and running it at the highest levels. This must have been quite an interesting year.
Yeah, he actually was born my junior year of college, and by all means, it was a shock. I just came off of Olympic trials, pretty typical female triad athlete. I had nothing was kind of going that was abnormal to me. My body did not feel any different. It was just kind of the normalcy of how I was. I was had extremely low body fat, and I just actually won nationals and SEC championship, and so did not think anything was going on. And shortly after the Olympic trials, discovered that I was pregnant, not only just pregnant, but pregnant by 22 weeks. So kind of way out there. And so I decided that this is the plan that God has for me and embraced it and found a great support system, especially with my coaching staff. And my teammates and his godmother and his godfather, and we just kind of embraced the issue and tackled it head on, and it was great. So we just kind of moved forward from there. But, yeah, now he's a little tiger. He's always been kind of this little tiger, even at birth. His very first outfit that he put on was a tiger outfit. So kind of fits perfectly.
Well, I'm told one of his babysitters when you were in school and Odell Sr. was in school was a guy named Shaquille O'Neal.
Yes, Shaquille O'Neal was one of the babysitters. It's kind of hard imagining that, but he actually was. He was a great support unit for everybody involved.
Well, this was November of 92. You have Odell Jr., right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then a few months later, you're running track again.
I'm running track. Yep, absolutely. They trained me, actually, a great training system all the way to the day of delivery. Literally, I was in a pool the day before. I've run those stadium stairs numerous times at 6 a.m., just like my teammates, even at 8 months pregnant. More so with monitors, heart monitors, et cetera, watching the heart rate and et cetera. But every single time I walk up those Tiger Stadiums, the flashback comes of walking stadiums at 6 a.m. with my son in tote, so to speak. And so, and then in March, we were back winning national championships, and I was a part of that. So they did a great job of just training me and getting my mindset prepared for what's to come. I've always kind of operated underneath that championship mindset and what it takes to be a champion and that determination, that perseverance, and that's what just kind of ingrained in me. And I just kept moving forward and never looking back. And while I was pregnant, instead of kind of thinking, which was the initial thought, like most people probably have, is, wow, what am I going to do? I remember when they set him on my stomach, I just kind of looked at him and said, well, here we go, kid. I'm not really sure what I'm going to do, but I'm going to be the best that I can possibly be for you. And I just kind of, like a carpenter with tools in his belt, I just kind of kept putting more tools in my belt. So I made sure I had my hammer, made sure I had my wrench, et cetera, et cetera. And just building up tools and avenues for him as he grew that he could succeed and walk down that pathway of success. So started him early in the classroom as well. After birth, didn't really have a daycare at first, and babysitters had to go to class too, right? So
yeah.
I said, well, you know what, let me call one of my professors and make sure it's okay if he comes. And he did, and he was very, very quiet. So he's been going to campus at the age of two, actually, sitting in classes.
So from 1994...
I'm sorry, 2 weeks old, forgive me.
Well, 1992 to the present, Odell Beckham Jr. has been attending classes at LSU. Heather Van Norman is our guest, the Nicholls State track and field and cross country head coach, and we will talk with her about her most recent assignment. She spent many years at Tulane as well, and that's where Odell was a high schooler in New Orleans at Newman while Heather was coaching the Greenies. But this is an amazing process you just described. In June of 92, you're in the Olympic trials in New Orleans, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
In November, you give birth to a baby, and then in March, you're winning national championships again.
Yep.
You must.
I kind of contribute that. Forgive me. I contribute that to just the grace of God. Again, my coaches have worked with me and all of the student athletes there, but they just kind of created this environment of success, and success can be measured on different levels. It doesn't always have to be about winning. But what it did create is just kind of this fire underneath me. And I just really realized, like, I am responsible for another life. And so it's time to, everything's going to become serious. And I've made it on the dean's list. I mean, I changed my grades. I changed, each class I was more attentive. Everything that I did was about raising my son, and I did it for the betterment. Every thought that I had was, well, what would my son do in this, am I bettering this environment for my son? And so we just kind of kept moving forward and pushing, and then we're struggling at times. You struggle and you kind of get down, and I recall numerous times just needing to study, and my roommates would help me out, or I would put him in his car seat and drive a couple blocks or a mile around Tiger Stadium or around Tiger Village and et cetera, and he would fall asleep, and I would take him out and lay him in his crib and study. So there's it's definitely a struggle, but it's been a blessing. I think God definitely put that scenario in my life for a reason, and here he is today.
Well, you had quite a ride at LSU, and this is obviously somewhat unconventional, but you pulled it off, and you're back in school. You're getting your master's while you're coaching the Colonels, right?
Yes, sir, and I'm loving it. I'm actually back at LSU getting my master's, and I'm just really, really enjoying the process. And, you know, I feel like I'm like a student for life, and I'm constantly learning. I'm learning about my profession. I'm learning about coaching. I'm learning about student athletes, about student affairs, et cetera. And I'm just really, really liking and enjoying the process of being back in school. And it's really, really nice because it's something that just kind of seemed so easy for me, which was coaching in my career and associating and dealing with student athletes has just kind of become a passion and a love. So it's nice. It's a good, quote, marriage, if you will.
Here's a question from Andrew asking if you knew immediately that Odell Jr. was going to be a great athlete. He obviously had good genetics.
Yeah, he's kind of a genetic lottery, if you will, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
Everything that he kind of touched, I know it sounds weird, but he always succeeded, or he was always kind of, he's very self-driven. He's very competitive. And he loves sports. So it ranges from soccer to basketball to, you know, tennis. His best friend's a tennis player, and he would go out and play tennis with him and probably still does when he has his off-season training. But nevertheless, and everything that he would do, he just kind of excelled in athletics. And what was great for him is his learning environment. He's a math, science-oriented mindset. And so everything that he would do, he related it back to a statistic from football. So that's how he learned kind of some of the processes of math. So I knew that he was going to be great to answer the question, or he was going to be good and excel in some area because it kind of became real natural for him. But when he became a student of the game, whatever sport that he was in, but became a student and really started to understand it, then you could start to see him excel. And I actually thought for a moment, I said, well, you know what, maybe soccer is his gig, you know. And I thought, well, maybe it's basketball because he went up to North Carolina. We took him up there. And Roy Williams, to the Roy Williams basketball camp, and, you know, Mr. Williams really liked him a lot. And he said, well, I'm going to play basketball. I said, well, that's a great sport. And then he came back, and then it was football. And football just kind of took leaps and bounds. And he really started to excel. To answer your question, yeah, I knew he was going to be a little athlete, but he's very, very versatile, and I like that about him. I never said, well, it's just one sport. In fact, there was a time when he was involved with, like, two sports at one time, you know, something maybe at Newman and something as a club sport, and that just kind of got overwhelming as a family and overwhelming for him. But that was the only time. But we always encourage, you know, you play a fall or spring sport. He ran track and field for a couple of years, and so I just kind of encourage being versatile.
Well, he is projected as a first-round draft pick when he goes professional, and he is a junior, but these days people like Odell usually leave early. I would imagine the odds are strong that this will be his final season at LSU. Has he made that decision?
No, we haven't made that decision. That's going to have to be a conversation that we've put off fully until the end of the year. I totally believe in God, and I kind of chuckle when I say it. I don't want to jinx anything, but that's going to have to be, you know, we want injury-free, see how the season goes. There's so much left of the season. I feel like these games, the boys have really been looking forward to, and I know I as a parent have been looking forward to them, and I know that they really want to play out these last three games extremely well. So that's been the focus. The focus is the academics, making sure that we're staying on top of that game and really being prepared for Alabama and Texas A&M and Arkansas. After that, then we will process forward. And he'll have to, you know, pray about it, stay prayed up, as he likes to say, speak with his coaches and just kind of make the best decision that's for him at that point, not for family or anything like that, but for him. And I know that he loves LSU, and I know that his, you know, he's going to graduate regardless, but we haven't really thought about anything more than that. There's maybe times when he's by himself and maybe a couple things that he's shared here or there, but one thing is for certain is that he loves being a Tiger, and
We'll hold tight with Heather Van Norman back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We resume our conversation with Nicholls State University head track and field and cross-country coach Heather Van Norman, former LSU All-American, and the mother of the spectacular Odell Beckham Jr. of the Fighting Tigers, LSU winning 48-16 Saturday at home, homecoming against Furman. And now the Tigers have a week off before playing at Alabama on November 9th. Odell, by the way, became the sixth Tiger in school history to exceed 1,000 yards receiving in a season this past Saturday. And he has four games to go. There will doubtless be a bowl game involved as well. You go to all the games, don't you, Heather?
Yes, sir. I've attended every single one this year. I'm really happy about that.
Do you get emotional?
I get very, very nervous, to be honest with you. I feel like my best analogy is probably the Olympics, right? The opening ceremonies. And if anybody's seen that, it kind of looks like chaos before. And then the crescendo happens, and then everybody kind of forms into place. Well, I feel like I'm the mom that's the preparation aspect of before the opening ceremony. So there's things that he likes and that he needs, and that last conversation that I have with him, or making sure that family members are secure and in their seats, and et cetera. And so I'm kind of that back person. And you know what, Jim? As soon as the lights go on, I'm cheering as loud as I can at opening ceremonies, and then as soon as the kickoff happens, it never fails. The butterflies come into my stomach, and I usually escape. My escape is to find the ramp, and I will watch it from the monitor, and I just kind of stand there prayerfully and walk up and down the ramps in the back and then peek around the corner and see how it's going. And so the last game I sat down in my seat the entire time, and the game before that, so I'm getting a little bit better, but yeah, I've attended every game. I've been blessed. I have a great support unit at Nicholls State as well, and with cross country, we run on Saturday early mornings or Friday evening, so that's worked out great with cross country, so I'm able to do both.
Well, how's it going? You're a mother with great devotion to Odell and your daughter, Jasmine, but also you're a student. You're commuting to LSU, and you're the head coach at Nicholls State in Thibodaux. How's that working out?
It's all about balance, to be honest with you. I've found the balance in my life, and right now my class is online, one of my classes online, so that really helps out. But I'm finding that support, and I'm finding that balance, and it's working out really, really well. I mean, there's late nights, but I was used to that. Working at Tulane, I would stay up relatively late, especially after the years of Katrina, because we had a lot of rebuilding and regrowth going on. And so I'm used to that, and I just kind of keep moving forward, and I keep God first, and he keeps the light going on in the tunnel, and I'm doing good right now, so that's a positive thing.
Well, the LSU women's track and field program has produced many All-Americans, and of course a plethora of national championships. I think as many national championships won by that one program as the others combined in all the other programs. And it is remarkable how many success stories beyond the arena we have, and almost 100% graduation. It's an amazing program that has probably, I don't think there's any probably about it, has not received the attention and the accolades it deserves.
Yes. Track and field is, you know, it's a sport that, you know, it's an Olympic sport. It's not that revenue-making sport, except for at LSU, where they do have their home meets, but it's not like putting on a football game or a men and women's basketball game. And it has the most accomplished on and off the track, if you will, I feel like, athletes. The stories, like you said, that just kind of surround each and every one of those athletes and the graduation rate. And, you know, in our sport, we normally, you know, in our sport, our kids graduate in 4 years or 5 years, and then they move on. So our APR ratings are relatively high versus men's basketball and men, you know, in football, where the guys can go early. But the main thing for them, and this is what I tell my son, is that you graduate. And he's very proud of that, and he's very determined that he will graduate. And he's talked about even education after that at some particular point. So he's very motivated to do that. But track and field, when I was involved with the program, we had won nationals 11 years in a row under Coach Pat Henley. And that says a lot. I mean, to kind of keep that steam going and that engine and to keep that train moving is a lot to do with the great environment and what the coaching staff is doing for the student-athlete. And success breeds success. And so it's very easy after that for coaches to recruit when they can say, hey, we had this accomplishment underneath our belt. You know, kids swarm to that. And a lot of Louisiana kids want to attend LSU and be a part of that program. And so I'm really, really pleased, and I get really excited, and I'm cheering just as loud when a Kimberly Duncan is being noticed on the field a few weeks ago, and I just gloat. I'm just smiling from ear to ear. I'm Lolo Jones, and I love it when our student athletes come back, and it's no different at Nichols. It was nothing different for me when I was involved at Tulane or University of Tennessee, but I like to see student athletes giving back to their school and coming back and being recognized for their accomplishments.
Well, it's great to visit with you, and you've created quite a visual image of you jogging up the steps at Tiger Stadium as a student with an infant in arms, and his name was Odell Beckham Jr. So who would have known 20 years later that he would be doing what he's doing? But I'm sure many are not surprised at his success based on his mother.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Heather. Coach Van Norman.
Thank you.
Take care and talk to you soon.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye. And we're joined now by State Treasurer John Neely Kennedy. Good morning, Mr. Treasurer.
Good morning, Jim.
And John Kennedy has one of the great names in American politics. Before we get to budget matters, your birthday is one day before the other John Kennedy died. You were 12 years old. Do you recall that day?
Yes, I do. My dad came and got my brothers and I out of school. I remember it very well.
Where were you? You were in Zachary?
I was in Zachary. I was in, I guess I would have been in junior high. But I remember my dad came and got all my brothers and I out of school. We went home. I remember it well.
We hear these stories, and I heard some over the weekend, and I believe them, that unfortunately in some schools in Louisiana, people cheered when the president, when the announcement was made that the president was dead. I hope that didn't happen in Zachary.
It didn't. And I did, at least in my household. I don't ever remember my parents saying anything bad about President Kennedy. I don't remember it happening at school. It may have happened in other places, but I don't ever remember hearing about anybody in Zachary say anything bad about the president at all.
Well, you were only 9 years old when he was elected president. I doubt that you were named after him, but were you teased as a kid about being the John Kennedy on the playground in Zachary?
Oh, sure. I've heard. I mean, I'm very proud of my name, and I like it. I'm used to it. It's been my name my whole life. But I've heard all the John Kennedy jokes imaginable, and sometimes it gets frustrating. But I tell people all the time, if I get frustrated with the jokes, it could be worse. My last name could be Wiener.
Do you think Kennedy was a good president?
I do. I mean, I think that it's hard to tell, Jim, how history would have treated him. He was in the process. President Kennedy was very conservative fiscally. He was in the process of trying to do a tax cut to help the American economy. He was being very cautious in terms of international affairs. I think everybody remembers the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I'm sure a lot of the historians give credit to a lot of different folks, but I know who was president then. And I remember my parents talking about we were going to, maybe if a nuclear war started, we would have to drive to Oklahoma, where my father was from, because he had family up there that had shelters for tornadoes. People can't imagine that today, but the threat that we were going to be at war was very, very real. I think most Americans thought we were going to be in a nuclear war. It was a very scary time, and he guided us through that, and I think Americans will always be grateful for that.
Well, I'm sure the name John Kennedy didn't hurt you in your political pursuits, and you've been at the game in the game for a long while. And we want to cover some ground with you. There's a budget surplus. I see our friend C.B. Forgotston's a bit skeptical about this $163 million surplus. He writes, perhaps knowing that you were going to be on the show, saying that a year ago the surplus was estimated $130 million.
Right.
Is this something to get excited about?
Well, it's certainly better than a deficit, and I hope it holds. We'll know more when we finally close the books. This is a preliminary estimate. We are limited, which I think is a good thing. Others disagree with me. If it holds up with how we can spend the money, it's one-time revenue, so we need to spend it on non-recurring expenses. I would like to see us use the money to pay down debt, but some will argue we ought to put it in the rainy day fund, which would be fine with me. We cannot use it in the operating budget, or shouldn't anyway. I'm sure there'll be an attempt to do that. These deficits and surpluses occur because the budgeting process is not an exact science. You make your best guess a year ahead of time what your revenue is going to be and your best guess about what your expenses are going to be, and you try to do both conservatively. And if you do it right, you're never going to hit it right on the penny, but if you do it right, you can have a surplus, and we did have a surplus this year, but I don't want to start celebrating till the books finally close.
Steve Wynnum, former budget director, a man you know well,
wants
you to comment about the essay you wrote regarding the financial risk of the privatization of Charity Hospital.
Well, first, I wish Wynnum would come back and help us in state government. He was one of the best budget directors we ever had. I mean, this guy was really, really good, and I think probably still is. But I don't blame him for, saying he's had enough. The hospitalization, as we know, the governor has leased our public hospitals, our charity hospitals, to private hospitals. And the administration said when we started this process, look, we're going to save a lot of money because a private hospital like Ochsner, for example, can operate a charity hospital more efficiently and therefore cheaper than the state can. But that hasn't been the case. Last year, as you know, Jim, our fiscal year begins July 1, so we're in about 4 months into our fiscal year. Last year, we spent about $955 million on our charity hospitals. When the governor's folks first rolled out their privatization, they said that this year, the year we're currently in, we would spend about $626 million. So you can see the savings. That's not how it's worked out. Our budget this year for the charity system is actually well over $1 billion after the privatization. So we are spending more this year than we spent last year. So where's the savings that the administration keeps talking about going to come from? If you dig into the details, you find that it's coming from an accounting change. We are using these lease payments that we get from the private hospitals to draw down more federal money. We're actually going to be spending, the savings is coming from additional federal money as a result of an accounting change. To briefly describe it, as you know, every dollar we put up in our Medicaid program, the feds put up too. So we lease a private hospital, let's say to an Ochsner. We give Ochsner the money to treat our uninsured and our low income. We give them the federal money. Ochsner turns around, makes a lease payment with the federal money. That money now becomes state money, and we use that state money to draw down more federal money. So we're not saving anything. We're just pulling in more federal money. But CMS has got to approve it. That's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and they have rejected these kind of financial strategies, some of them anyway, in the past.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on with John Kennedy.
Good morning, sir. And I just got to say from the get-go just to thank you for your work, and I also admire what your esteemed brother does. But my questions to you are about where do we go from here in terms of getting some progress. I know privatization would be great if I had a company and could be assured of getting a repeat budget every year. I wouldn't have to compete in the free market. So I really think privatization is hurting us.
Good question. Thank you on behalf of both my brother and I for your compliment. What we need to do with this new financial accounting, which is designed to attract more federal money, is to immediately go to Washington, to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS as we call it, to get their approval. Now, CMS has rejected some of our strategies like this in the past. In the early 1990s, Louisiana and a lot of other states used financing strategies like provider taxes, provider donations, intergovernmental transfers. They were all designed to, for lack of a better word, launder federal Medicaid funds into state funds in order to draw down more federal funds. In fact, our health care budget in Louisiana went from $1.6 billion in 1988 to $4.5 billion in 1993. 90% of it was federal money using these financing strategies, and then the Fed shut us down. And the governor, Foster, had been elected governor. We were looking at a $1 billion deficit. We had to get special dispensation from Congress, and they made us stop doing what we were doing. I'm not saying that'll be the case this time. I don't know what CMS will say, but we need to go to CMS immediately and ask them to approve this new accounting, because if they don't, if we find out a year from now or 2 years from now, we're going to have to unwind these transactions, and about 2 million people depend on our charity hospitals.
I'm looking at a story a month ago, exactly. It says Treasurer John Kennedy gave non-governmental organizations called NGOs until October 15th to detail how they spend $1.2 million in state dollars. Did they reach the deadline you imposed?
Some did. Some were still reviewing. Some didn't, and those that didn't, I have already turned them over to the legislative auditor to audit them more in more detail, and to the Office of Debt Recovery, Tim Barfield at Revenue, who is going to sue to get our money back and try to seize assets.
This is something that you've been involved with for some time. Do you think these NGOs should just go by the wayside?
Yeah, I do, most of them. And at a minimum, I think everybody at the Capitol gym knows what's going on. They get buried in the budget, and most of them are there to take care of somebody's politics. I think at a minimum, what we ought to do is take them, separate them out from the budget, and let the legislature vote on them individually.
We'll be back with Treasurer John Kennedy after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane is producing. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org works by email. In the New York Times Saturday, the New York Times editorial page took aim at Governor Bobby Jindal, saying, under Governor Bobby Jindal, Louisiana has been slashing support for higher education with funding for Grambling down 56% since 2008, and funding for public colleges down 48%. What's ailing the football program at Grambling is also ailing the university as a whole, writes the New York Times. And if the players are looking for somewhere to place blame, they should consider the state government. Your thoughts, Treasurer Kennedy?
Well, I read the New York Times. I don't agree with a lot of their editorials, but they have a very valid point here. I mean, I think we've clearly cut higher education to the bone. The administration would disagree with that. They say, well, we've cut general fund support, but we've raised tuition. I don't think we've raised tuition to equal the lack of general fund support, and even if we had, I'm in the minority on this, but I don't think that we ought to be raising tuition anymore. I think that we tell kids that we want them to go to school and then we raise the price. That doesn't make sense to me. Clearly, universities have become last in terms of our priorities, even though we say they're at the top and something needs to be done. That's why it's so important to get this this healthcare delivery system, Medicaid stuff, and straight, do it right, because if we do it wrong and we have to pour more money into it, that's going to come out of the hide of our universities.
297-5633. We will go back to the phone lines, but I did want to also ask the treasurer about an essay he wrote, headline, Louisiana Bondholders and Taxpayers Are Protected from Default. How so?
Every penny of revenue that the state gets in goes into a special fund called the Bond Security and Redemption Fund. I use that Bond Security and Redemption Fund, the money in it, to pay the debt on our bonds before I pay anybody else. Our bonds get paid before we pay teachers, governors, treasurers, legislators, health care, education. Bondholders get paid first. So for all practical purposes, it's impossible for us to default on our bonds. If the feds did the same thing, it would help a lot in terms of our credit rating.
What did you make of the chaos in Washington that went on for 16 days?
I wasn't surprised. I think it's going to continue. The president and the Congress are clearly, at least a part of the Congress, are clearly miles apart. The problem we have in America is real simple in terms of the numbers. We've got a huge spending deficit. We've got a huge national debt. National debt, since the president's taken office, has gone up 57%. And we know we can't sustain that. So there are only two ways to deal with it. Number one, you can raise taxes. Or number two, you can reduce your spending. And one side wants to reduce spending, and the other side wants to raise taxes. And if they can't find some middle ground, the stalemate will continue.
Well, the stalemate went on for some time. This is an issue that is not going away. You sought to become a member of the U.S. Senate. Last week on this show, Carl Bernstein reflected on how the House of Representatives, because of what he termed gerrymandering, it has pushed Democratic districts more leftward and Republican districts more rightward, and to the point where almost all of the members of the U.S. House have no threat from the other party. Their only threat is coming from the right or the left in their own party. And he says this has caused the government to be broken. Do you share that observation?
Well, Mr. Bernstein's right about the districts. I mean, just go look at Louisiana's district. No rational person, unless he or she was blind, with a blindfold on, would draw these districts that way. I mean, everybody knows when the legislature does it, there's a lot of politics involved, and it would be much better, in my opinion, for the states to turn the job over to bipartisan commissions who aren't politicians, who aren't trying to protect themselves or their friends. Now, is that going to happen? Probably not, at least not in Louisiana. But our districts in here in Louisiana, they're either very, very conservative districts or, relatively speaking, more liberal districts. It would be very hard for a Republican to beat Cedric Richmond, our Democratic congressman from New Orleans. Conversely, as you know, we've got a congressional election going on in the 5th, and the two people in the runoff are both Republicans. So the districts, all you have to do is look at the districts and see that they are pretty weird looking.
All right, here's another question from Antoinette, who asks about the governor rejecting the Medicaid money that was available in Obamacare. Did he make the right call?
I think he did, and I say that for two reasons. Number one, I know the feds are saying they were going to pay 100% for a while and then 90% after that, but I look at their balance sheet, and I don't think they'll be able to do that. Number two, I can't believe we, I don't believe we should expand the program until we're allowed to fix the problems in it, and there are a lot of problems in our Medicaid program. But what's ironic about what we're doing with this privatization, Jim, the governor and our Department of Health and Hospitals has rejected the Medicaid portion of the Affordable Care Act, and I agree with them. But they're trying to go through the back door when they refuse to go through the front door. The privatization, as best I can tell, the whole purpose of it is to draw down more federal money. So with our right hand, we're saying, no, federal government, we don't want the federal money with Obamacare. And I happen to think that's the right decision. But then we're turning right around and quietly going through the back door and trying to get more federal money through this privatization. And I think the Louisiana taxpayers and the American taxpayers need to be told the truth about what we're doing. Let me say it again. The governor's making the right decision, in my opinion, right now, about the Medicaid expansion. And my question is, well, then why are we trying to do it through the back door with privatization?
And you said a moment ago that the budget for health care has actually gone up.
Yeah. We're spending over $1 billion this year for our public hospitals. Last year, it was $955 million, so it's actually gone up as a result of privatization. Commissioner Nichols at the Christie Nichols, fine person at the division, predicted that this year we would be spending $626 million. So she was about $400 million off. I know these things are hard to gauge, but you can't tell people, well, privatization is going to save money by we won't have to spend as much, and then spend $400 million more than you predicted.
So what happened? What caused the $400 million gap?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I just know that their initial predictions were $626 million and is now over $1 billion, and they ran short. They had to go to Children's Hospital in New Orleans and ask them to make an extra lease payment, basically borrow money from Children's to meet the budget numbers. I think what they're expecting is that this new accounting to draw down federal money, more federal money, will bail them out. And it will if the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in Washington agrees with it.
877-217-5757 in our remaining time with State Treasurer John Neely Kennedy, a man who's been around Louisiana politics for a long time. He was a close advisor to both Governor Buddy Romer and Governor Mike Foster, and he assumed office as treasurer after being revenue secretary in 2000. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. The president, I think, is on the right track. The national debt as a percentage of GDP has gone from 9% in 2008 to about 4% this year. As I think he's doing a fine job. But my question is this. Earl Kahlon was contracted over to the Lady of the Lake without any competitive bid, and everyone in the state seems to be okay with that. I kind of think it smells of RICO, but I'd be interested to see how you feel about it, Mr. Treasurer.
Well, I have always believed, and I still believe this, that all things being equal, tapping the expertise of hospitals like Lady of the Lake, Ochsner, Baton Rouge General, and I'm obviously leaving some out, to manage our charity hospitals can save money. I do believe that a Lady of the Lake can manage a hospital better than the state can. And we were told with privatization that's what was going to happen, but that's not happening. As best I can tell, and I hope the governor will set me straight if I'm wrong, this whole privatization is an accounting change to draw down more federal money. We're actually going to be spending more, not less. So, you know, I just think the people in Louisiana need to be told straight up what's going on here, that the lake is not running it cheaper than the state. We're using their lease payments, which they give to us with our own money, to draw down federal money. I'm not putting down the Lady of the Lake. They've got to worry about their own fiscal circumstances, and they're going to do that, and I hope they do that. It's a wonderful hospital, but they're not running it cheaper than the state, not under the contracts I've looked at.
Wasn't that the primary reason for doing it?
Yeah. what the taxpayers were told, but that's not how it's ended up. Look, Robert Attlee, we recently had hearings at the Joint Legislative Budget Committee. Robert Attlee asked the chairman of the private entity taking over the Shreveport Charity Hospital, said, compare our costs to your costs. He testified, look, probably they're going to be about the same. And I'm thinking, whoa, where's the $150 million worth of savings going to come from? And there's only, then you drill down and look at it, Jim, and this is an accounting mechanism to draw down more federal money. And it can work. It's very clever. But CMS has got to approve it. And CMS has shut us down before back in the early 1990s. In fact, the person who was sent in to clean it up in the early 1990s was Secretary Bobby Jindal, then Secretary of DHH. I don't want to do this and then find out 2 years from now that because we don't apply for approval that CMS is going to come in and say, no, we're not going to approve this. What are we going to do then? We got to unwind the whole transaction.
Well, you're citing a disconnect. You talk front door, back door, as far as the state thumbing its nose at the feds at one door and then begging from the feds at the other. A man who you may or may not agree with most of the time, Foster Campbell, he says that the governor should refrain from being so harsh in his criticism of the president, that this doesn't do any good when the state is seeking money from the federal government. Do you share that observation?
I'm not much about getting into the personalities. I know Foster. I like him a lot. I'm interested in policy, Jim. You know what I would do with trying to fix Medicaid? If you look at the Medicaid annual report, 3% of our Medicaid patients spend 43% of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. 42,000 people out of 1.4 million who are on Medicaid spend $3 billion or 43% of the money. Now, I know what you would do if you were Secretary of DHH. You'd say, let's go find these 42,000 people and find out what's going on. We could afford to hire a nurse for every one of them to save money. That's the sort of reform in Medicaid spending that I think we ought to do.
All right, that's 3% of the recipients pay. They're responsible for how much of the cost?
43%.
And so that would mean 97% are responsible for 57%. Okay.
That's correct.
All right. A couple of questions from listeners. One wants to know if there's any movement on the sale of those state buildings that was in the budget, wasn't it?
It is. If we don't sell them, we'll have to do cuts to higher ed. Not to my knowledge, but anybody out there wants to buy a state building, please give us a call. Well, give the governor or the commissioner a call, or call me and I'll transfer you over.
Well, one's at the corner of Convention and 3rd Street. I think it's on the block for $10 million.
Yeah.
That's an expensive building.
Yeah, and if we don't get that, we went through this with the lot, the old insurance building lot next to the hospital, next to the Capitol, where they pretended they were going to sell it for $5 or $6 million, and the appraisal was always around $2.5 million, and it's still not sold. I worry we'll figure something out, but all this is a kind of a charade, in my opinion. But the problem is, it's not a game because if the sales don't come through, higher ed gets cut, and they can't take much more, Jim.
Well, here's another one, and it may be tough considering your admiration and association with the former governor, but a listener wants to know if the $2 million earmarked for a place for Governor Foster's papers in Franklin is money well spent.
Well, I am biased. I used to work for Mike, and I worked for Buddy. I will say, I don't want to get into personalities. I really don't, but we ought to treat all governors the same. You know, we really ought to treat all governors the same. If we're going to do centers for them like the presidents do, then we ought to do that and treat them all the same. If we're going to ask them all to turn their papers over the archives, we ought to treat everybody the same. Presidents have centers, as you know, the Bill Clinton Center in Washington and the George Bush Center. Of course, the difference is the presidents have to go raise their own money. They don't get federal money for it. But I'm not going to begrudge Governor Foster that. He's a great guy, and I did work for him, and I was very, very proud to work for him. But I do think we ought to treat all the governors the same.
So we should have the Romer Center and the Treen Center and the Blanco Center and the Edwin Washington Edwards Center.
Yeah, if they want it, I mean, I think you've got to treat everybody the same. I think that's the only fair way.
Well, Treasurer Kennedy, it's always nice to talk with you. Let's do it again soon, and have a good birthday.
Thank you, Jim. Take care.
We'll be back tomorrow for J.C. Kane. I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.